Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Hi, this is Connie Stevens with Virginia Public Radio. Today, host Maylily Lee brings you a recorded program, interviews with two Virginia entrepreneurs. One is Sheila Johnson from the world of BET Networks, professional sports, and the resort industry. She'll tell us about her newest luxury resort coming to Middleburg, Virginia. But first, Maylily begins with an interview we recorded several weeks ago with Rowena Fullenwider, who grew a small Norfolk bakery into a brand known worldwide. She's the founder of Rowena's Kitchen in Norfolk, and we are saddened to report that soon after the interview, Rowena passed away. We'd still like to share her story, a memorial to Rowena Fullenwider and her talents. The chapter of her story that we're sharing begins with friends and family raving about her almond pound cake. As word spread about the cake lady, she turned her kitchen into a business. And in 1983, she opened a gourmet manufacturing facility and Rowena's Gourmet Foods. Here's host Maylily Lee.
Rowena, welcome to Virginia Conversations. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
You started in 1983 with your business in the Ghent section of Norfolk. Love the Ghent section. It's a wonderful neighborhood to be in, and continued the business for 28 years. But it didn't start with you just simply saying, I think I'll start a business. It started with people's love of your almond pound cake.
Well, I had used it as to raise funds, as a fundraiser for a variety of reasons. You know how you do with your school and your church and your organizations. My business actually, I didn't pick it. It picked me.
And this almond pound cake, that was your signature cake to begin with. Can you tell me what made it special?
It's still the most popular. Well, it's absolutely wonderful tasting. You freeze the cakes, and they last forever.
How do you keep a pound cake moist? That's always a challenge, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I can't answer that for you because I don't really know. I just worked in. It was my mother-in-law's recipe, and I made a lot of changes.
Or are you just slipping by so you don't have to share secrets?
No. I can't. It's a chemical thing, and it's very hard to understand.
Well, here's another goodie that I've only learned about recently. I'm not from California, and I understand that just about every Californian knows what you're talking about when you say lemon curd. And
oh,
this is something you've made very popular.
Yes, lemon curd is actually British, and I don't know why it's so popular in California, except it tastes so good. It's a little bit translucent, and it has a strong lemon flavor, and it's very smooth. You can put it on anything.
And Rowena's Bakery serves lemon curds and other curds as well, right?
Oh, yes.
Well, what I thought I'd do is discuss at least the classic recipe I saw around lemon curd. Without all of the specifics, but just so folks will know what goes into this, it's pure yumminess. Lots of eggs, sugar, lemon juice, lemon zest, butter. I didn't say margarine. I said butter. And then these, you know, the lemon juice, they say, should really be that sort of Meyer lemon, that cross between oranges and a mandarin orange and a lemon. Does that sound like a classic curd?
It does, except I don't know that I would cross it with a Meyer.
So you'd use lemons.
Lemon, yeah.
Okay. And what among your products became your favorites?
Oh, definitely the almond pound cake. My mother-in-law and I she lived in Seattle, and she would come to visit, and we would make the almond pound cake and eat half of it while it was warm before the children got home.
You know, I almost believe you, Rowena, except for I've seen pictures of you, and you don't look like a woman who loves almond pound cake.
Well, I do.
And when we talk...
Freezing improves the moisture level.
So when we talk about this calling of yours, and you say you were, you know, it called you, rather than vice versa, or do you consider yourself a baker, or was that something that you were just drawn to?
I am a Navy wife. And I entertained and cooked all the time. And I didn't, before I got married, I came from a family of girls and we all had our jobs. And mine was sewing and my sister's was cooking. But after I got married, I became pregnant with my first child, I don't know, I just used to get up in the middle of the night and bake and bake and bake and bake and give it all away the next day.
I know that in the 28 years that you ran Rowena's, one of the traditions that I personally love across the country is the tradition of the tea room, which is vanishing across
Definitely
the nation.
Definitely vanishing. It's very sad.
But Rowena's Tea Room in Norfolk was the destination. Tell me about that.
Well, it was a lot of TLC, and we made divine little sandwiches on tea trays, three trays. And
did you cut off the crust?
Oh, yes.
Good.
And then we added, of course, our cake, and we added the curds. I think I was one of the first manufacturers to make curds, and it was a long educational process to get people to try it and enjoy it. And we also had scones. We had the most divine scones. They were a big favorite, and that's wonderful for lemon curd.
Spread some nice lemon curd on a good scone. That sounds delectable.
And we had our own scone recipe, which is a little different because it's softer.
Part of the fun of going to a tea room is the culture of it. For those who have never experienced that culture, explain what one... I know it starts with making an appointment. You don't just show up at a tea room.
No, it would be very hard if you did on the staff. People would just make an arrangement. Some people came dressed to the nines with hats and gloves, and some people just came in with their families or by themselves. We had one doctor that used to bring his wife. He's now 100 plus. She has since died, every once a week to have tea with her. That was a treat, a real treat for them. Going to a tea room is a restful experience, or it's supposed to be. But sometimes it becomes a great, big, happy party because everybody's there for the same reason, to enjoy. It's not like a restaurant.
Let's talk a little bit about the book you published in 2002, Celebrate Virginia, The Hospitality, History, and Heritage of Virginia. It's a book that weaves your recipes, and I imagine your family's recipes, too, yes?
Yes, some. I wrote to people all over the state to get recipes from Virginia. And some of them were so interesting. I got one recipe with a felt tip pen from an older gentleman on the back of a paper towel. It was just a beautiful experience. My husband said he got to know all the little old ladies in the state.
Former Senator John Warner gave you his crab cake recipe.
Yes, he did. That was a coup.
Now, in addition, you talk in the book about various traditions in Virginia. You discuss shad planking, the annual political and social event in Wakefield every April.
Yes, I attended that, of course, and it is a wonderful event. And everyone comes and enjoys.
Now, in 1987, Rowena, your bakery became the first to carry the Virginia's Finest trademark. And that was the mark of high-quality products that came from only Virginia.
Well, Virginia had a lot of small gourmet businesses, and they had quality products. They really worked at it. And so we were all friends, you know. We became friends and got to know each other. And so we went to the Department of Agriculture and said, look, we've got something here that's good for marketing the state of Virginia. And they came up with the logo, and that's what started it. And we're all still good friends to this day.
And it still continues today. That's
yes,
really great.
Yes, it does. And you have to send in samples and pass the taste test, so to speak. And it's really been wonderful and exciting, and they have a convention every year, pick winners, and we have a whole variety of products.
I want to share with you something that showed up on a blog about your bakery, and this came about the time that you sold the bakery a couple of years ago. The name continues. It's still Rowena's Bakery. And here's what the writer says. Rowena's is not a regular bakery. Rowena's is a specialty boutique bakery that did something no other bakery in America did. She sold boutique bakery goods all over the world from Norfolk, products going to Russia, Europe, Canada, and more, with hundreds of employees at its peak to service the demand. Plus, every regular bakery owes a debt to Rowena's. They helped change the law in Washington about the bakery business. At one point, a Rowena cake was placed on the desk of every legislator in Congress about to vote on a small business bill. It was a room full of Rowenas. So tell us about that measure.
Oh, that was very interesting. It was about the Nutritional Labeling Act and LEA 90. And they wanted all businesses to have nutritional labeling. Well, that's very, very expensive. And FDA got a hold of it, and they started making it mandatory, and every time the recipe, every 3 months or every 4 months, which was very expensive for a small business. And I believe in nutritional labeling, very much so. But I didn't want them to have to bear the expense of doing it so often, number one, and number two, redoing all the labels every time you did it. I mean, it was just outrageous. FDA just went overboard. And I don't think Congress meant it that way. So I started writing letters. My husband helped me. And it was just a very intense time. And we finally got a lovely lawyer out of Washington who helped us. And our industry, the NASFT, came on board and helped bear some of the expense of it.
And you were victorious.
Yes, and all it was a small business exemption. If you sold, so many cakes of one item, then you would have nutritional labeling. Well, none of us did that. We were too small.
That's phenomenal. I'm picturing you as Reese Witherspoon in Legally Blonde, too, taking on D.C.
Well, it was a little bit like that because when you testify, you have a red light, a yellow light, and a green light. And I got up on the stage to testify. I have no idea what I said. But when I finished, men stood on their chairs in the back and clapped. It was, because all the big companies got up there with their lawyers in dark suits. And it was just me and my husband. He didn't go on the stage, of course. But it was just the two of us in the audience until it was my turn.
So you were the David up against the Goliath. How did your husband factor into your business life?
He did not work at the factory, but he was an incredible support all through it, and still is.
I suppose you couldn't have run your own business and grown it to the size to which you grew it without someone cheering you on, rather than saying, honey, how come my 5 o'clock supper's not on the table?
Exactly. That is interesting that you said that, because he never called and said, where's dinner? He doesn't cook.
Did you ever have to tell him, look, if you want to see me, you'll have to show up in the shop?
Oh, no. He came. He was fascinated by the factory and loved all the people that worked there. And he came if he wanted to.
Now, in 2010, which was about a year before you sold your business, you shipped an entire pallet of cakes to Iraq, to the troops.
Yes, we did. That was, my husband was a naval officer, and the military is very important in our lives, and we were able to have that privilege.
Now, talk to me about the sale of your business. You didn't tap just any old buddy who came off the street. I know you put a lot of thought into who you would sell this to, and that there were large corporations actually interested in buying your business.
Well, it's a unique business, and it needed a person that was unique, I guess you could say. A small business. I thought a small business person was the best option, and that's what it turned out to be.
And this young man, Mr. McCormick, John McCormick,
yes,
came to you. And I know there was a little bit of serendipity there as well, because you learned that there was a tie between his wife and your original building.
I know, Small's Hardware, which had a fabulous gift shop. And grandfather owns it.
And as a lesson to any small business owner or someone interested in a second chapter, John had no experience in the bakery business.
No, he didn't.
He had been working with Auto Trader for a while. And had considered many different businesses, went on to get his business degree, and came to you.
That is correct.
What was it about John's plan that captured you?
Well, he said all the right things. He did. He's a warm person, and he sensed what I was working towards.
Now, I understand that the very first proposal he came to you with was one you didn't like, actually.
No.
It wasn't love at first sight.
No, it wasn't, but eventually he came with another proposal that worked.
Are you able to share what those differences were for us?
No, I don't I don't know whether I would be interested, but I don't remember them.
Yeah.
When I left the business. I really left the business.
I understand. Do you continue to bake?
No, I do not.
Okay. And let me ask you this. In the end, when you finally picked him, and as you say, you left the business, would you say that the best move you made was to ensure that it was someone who would keep it local?
Well, I was a national business, and I don't know whether he senses that it's a national business or whether he wanted it more local.
But it certainly was going to be a huge departure from other companies that wanted to move your business to their factories.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I was very interested in that, keeping my employees. They were very loyal and loving, and we were a family.
And I understand that was part of the deal, that it would be incumbent upon him to keep, at least for now, your 10 employees on staff when he bought the business.
Correct.
Yeah, and I'm sure. Give me an idea of the length of time they had served with you.
Oh, some of them had been there the whole 18 years.
Oh, goodness.
28 years. One of them even retired from there. So you can see how long they had been there.
You know, when you describe that, I think of the place in Richmond, Sally Bell's, which has a history, a long heritage of longtime employees at its lovely shop as well.
And they knew all their customers, and the customers loved them.
Yes. Did you ever stop in at Sally Bell's for a box lunch when you were in Richmond?
No, I don't. I don't travel very far these days.
Okay. You missed out because they put a little cheese cookie in that lunchbox that makes the whole lunch.
Oh, what a divine idea.
It is great. I thought a great way to round out here is, you know that I was fixated with the curd concept since I'd never heard of curds until recently.
Have you tasted it?
No.
Oh, my dear.
No, and I'm dying now to try any kind of curd.
I think ours is the smoothest and the best.
I'm ready to try a Rowena's Bakery lemon curd. I thought it would be fun, however, to read this excerpt from you from an author who is unknown. And the question is, what in the world is a cheese curd? A cheese curd is an orangish cheese byproduct that feels like silly putty, but tastes a lot better. It was invented accidentally by UW cheese scientists attempting to create an object of pure cholesterol that would still squeak.
Oh, that's so true.
Rats who are fed this remarkable food develop an unusual capacity to polka and drink beer.
That's true.
Rowena, what a pleasure to join us today. It was great to have you with us.
Well, thank you for calling me. I appreciate it. And you're a lovely lady, and I wish you the very best.
That was Rowena Fullenwider talking with May Lily Lee about her life and career. We're sorry to share that Rowena Fullenwider recently passed away just after our interview, but we hope you enjoyed this tribute. I'm Connie Stevens, and you're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Stay with us. Up next, we're talking to entrepreneur Sheila Johnson.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. I'm May Lily Lee, and today we're talking with entrepreneur Sheila Crump Johnson. It's hard to say what she's best known for. Perhaps that she was the co-founder in 1980 of Black Entertainment Television, or that she became the first African-American woman to hold ownership in three professional sports teams. Or maybe as the CEO and founder of Salamander Hospitality, a group of resorts and hotels whose flagship is coming to Virginia. She's truly a Renaissance woman. Sheila Johnson, welcome to Virginia Conversations. How are you today?
I am doing terrific. I've just been outside in my golf cart looking at the Virginia countryside. I'm actually planning a wedding for a godchild at my farm, so it's been fun.
And what part of Virginia are you talking to us from?
The Plains in Fauquier County, yeah.
Beautiful. Well, while we're talking about beautiful parts of Virginia, let's discuss your Middleburg Resort, Salamander Resort and Spa, scheduled to open this August.
Right.
This project began back in 2002 when you began dreaming about it. What was the inspiration?
Well, the inspiration was really as I had gone up on the property, and it was like the light bulb went off. And as I was looking into the Bull Run Mountains and then down on to the town of Middleburg, I said, this is a perfect place. It started out as an inn, and then it gradually got larger because smarter people than I am at the time said, there's no way you're going to make your money back on an inn. And said, if you're going to do it right. And it's 340 acres of beautiful property. And that's where I started envisioning the whole idea of doing this resort and spa.
And I know you've already broken ground. The resort is about 35 minutes outside of Dulles Airport.
Right.
It will feature 168 rooms and LEED certified. I was fascinated to read.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was really important that we, I'm very environmentally conscious, I should say. And it was important that as the way, you know, everything's going the way the world's going, we needed to be extremely sensitive to that. I mean, and we are in the countryside of Virginia, and I just wanted to really be able to help people appreciate the environment and to be able to feel inspired by it and feel, take responsibility for the environment. And they could learn those things at the resort, which we'll be putting in front of them, you know, no water bottles. They're going to be able to fill up one bottle that we'll give them a check-in. So we won't have lots of plastic around. And to just be able to enjoy fresh food. We've planted gardens out there where they'll be able to go out and choose their herbs and talk with the chef, and the chef will walk out there with them to really understand and enjoy what the earth has to offer. And the LEED certification, I just think, really is the umbrella of the idea of why we're doing what we're doing.
You're not new to the resort industry. You already have resorts out of state.
Right. I have three resorts in Florida, Innisbrook, which is in Clearwater, which is, I have four golf courses there, a 900-acre resort, and it has a spa and three clubhouses and lots of conference space. We have 67,500 square feet of conference space there. And the second resort is in Orlando, which is called Reunion, which is near Disney. The third resort is Hammock Beach, which is on the Palm Coast. And each one of the resorts, you know, provides something that's different. Innisbrook is in a very bucolic countryside, but near the beaches of Clearwater, really about 5 minutes away. But really with the property is absolutely pristine for the golf courses. And Reunion, of course, is near Orlando, and we got a big water park. We have water parks at all three of the resorts. But Reunion, it's more of the Disney Orlando feel. And then Hammock Beach is right on the beach, so it's got beautiful golf courses and terrific food and spa. So I've created the Grand Gulf Resorts of Florida. So our membership at all three literally can go to any one of these resorts and enjoy what we have to offer. And, of course, you know, anyone can come to it. But we do have members that get, you know, special discounts and everything that actually either own property at the resort and are able to move between the resorts. Each resort is an hour and a half from each other.
May I brag on Virginia a little? The Salamander Yes. Resort and Spa coming to Middleburg, Virginia, will be your flagship.
That is my flagship. That is the crown jewel. This is what I've been working on all these years while I've purchased these other resorts. But this is my baby. This is the one that I'm so proud of. It's one that you will see my thumbprint on everything and every inch of that resort. It's a design that I've been working with the architectural firm WATG out of Newport Beach. It's been a dream of mine. I've designed from the inside out, from the linens to even the photography on the wall, a lot of the artwork, and we have a lot of other Virginia artists on the walls. We are really showcasing Virginia and Virginia wines.
Sheila Johnson, a lot of people would call the hospitality industry your second act after BET, but really, it's your third act. Could you explain what you did before co-founding Black Entertainment Television?
Well, I actually was and still am, a violinist. I started the violin at age 9 and continued all the way through and majored in it at the University of Illinois, received degrees, education, performance, and then went on to play in string quartets, Trenton Symphony, Chicago Civic Symphony, then Trenton, and continued to play even solo performances. Actually did a concert, an all Beethoven concert in the Rayburn House office building on the hill in my braver days. But more importantly, I was a teacher of the instrument, and I had some of the most spectacular students. It was 140 total. I was able to really pull together some young people, and they didn't have to be exceptionally talented, but I pulled out everything that they could give me, and they were just an incredible group of young performers. And one day we were doing a performance at the old post office pavilion, and Queen Noor of Jordan walked in with her delegation. And to make a long story short, she had selected my orchestra to perform at the Jerash Festival in Jordan. And Jerash is just outside of Amman, about an hour bus ride, which is the oldest, it's an El Greco-Roman city that was that they were able to find. It had been buried by an earthquake. And it's really the Olympics of the cultural festival over there. And so we represented the United States along with two other arts groups. I think it was the Minnesota School for the Deaf and the Dixieland Jazz Band. And we were the only children involved. And so that was a great first act, which was also a way of, as we're starting a new company, to be able to keep paying the bills. And we moved slowly into that second act of getting BET started. And then in 1989, I did, I really gave up the violin completely to be full-time in the company.
Let's talk about BET. You and your then-husband, Robert Johnson, founded BET, and today it reaches more than 65 million U.S. homes. Of course, somewhere along there in 1997, you did sell the company to Viacom. Mm-hmm. But when you started BET, did you imagine its massive expansion?
Well, I can tell you, whenever you're starting a company, you have a great vision, and you keep focusing on that vision, because if you don't have that vision, it'll never grow. In the back of my mind, yes, that's where we wanted to end up. It was very tough starting out. It was hard getting advertising, and all the other cable networks were giving birth at the time. But I knew we had a really targeted audience, and it was an audience that no one else was reaching. We could reach it, and it really filled a void in the African-American community. Even though we had Ebony and Essence and, you know, print media, Jet, there was no media that was just targeted to the African-American audience. And when we took the idea to John Malone out in Denver, he immediately saw the value in starting this network. And I tell you, he was there from us from the beginning to the end. And really, he invested a lot of money in helping us. He was our guardian angel. And as the brand grew, and you see what the brand is like now, we were able to then, you know, Viacom made us an offer, and it was at the right time. And it's just worked out great.
I know your vision back then was that it would be a televised version of Ebony Magazine with public affairs, with news. You had a show called Teen Summit.
Yes.
But so much has changed, and I know that not for the better in your mind. What BET has become today, give us an idea of what your opinion is.
Well, it's really a, what do you call it? It's nothing but videos. It's sitcoms that are either have been resurrected, or it's sitcoms of trying to do original program. And it really, it's the steak without the sizzle, if you want to talk about it. It's really about music shows. It's video shows. It's award shows. Every time you turn around, it's like, you know, everyone's having either, you know, they're copying off the Grammys or something, and that's really the bread and butter of it all.
Do you think that's the fate of cable broadcasting in general?
Something is happening. It's in a transition point. I think there's too much cable. There are too many choices, I should say, on television. And I think I read some statistics. People only really watch 8 channels. And we have got, what, over 400? And it's just a matter, and I don't know how they're really looking at all this, you know, between pay-per-view and all these others. I don't know how they're measuring, you know, what people are watching. But I will tell you this, between HBO and some of these other, I think it's HBO and Showtime, they have really have become the dominant channels.
Now, about 6 years ago, you released the documentary film A Powerful Noise, and
right,
because you're such a staunch advocate for women's empowerment, it seems like the perfect vehicle. Tell us about that project.
Well, I was a global ambassador for CARE for 6.5 years, and as I was transitioning personally in my life as a divorced woman, we all, you know, we do hit moments of low points, but what happened, I was asked to become a global ambassador for CARE, and as I was really traveling around and meeting these women who are in such desperate situations, you know, living off of less than a dollar a day, gender-based violence, many of them had been raped and acquired AIDS, they had such strength, and I could see it in them, but they weren't given the chance to really take the responsibility for their lives like they wanted to. So what I did is I launched an I Am Powerful campaign, and I did that through CARE, and I was able to raise $12 million for this program. And these monies went back into the villages to help these women become entrepreneurs, to help set up businesses so that they could take over their lives and take on responsibility. It made them a lot stronger in the sense that since they had control of their lives, they were able to stop a lot of the things that were happening to them. It's really interesting to watch the transformation. We've also done it through sports. These women, I even have a homeless women's soccer team now, and I could see the transitioning by them having better self-esteem either through playing sports or setting up businesses where they then were able to take control of their lives. They didn't have to put up with a lot of what was going on that these men were subjecting them to. So I was able to see that transformation in them, and as they were transforming, I was transforming personally and becoming stronger. And so we were sort of helping each other to get through the rough periods in life. And it was challenging in a way, but it was also really rewarding.
I love this quote from you that came out of Contribute magazine, quote, "Women and children are the most exploited people in the world. Research shows that if we can improve the lives of women, then they will improve the lives of their children, their communities, their families. The reason I'm focusing on women is because they've been neglected for centuries. That is powerful because you're not taking away from men. You're simply saying, let's empower the women.
Exactly. And what we have found in everything that I was doing, that the men then garnered more respect for the spouse or the significant other in their lives. And I have seen that, you know, as we bring up our daughters, we want them to be strong. We want them to be self-confident. We want them to be able to be resilient and be able to take on the challenges in life so that they can continue to grow emotionally and physically. When you take away those ingredients out of their lives, they are not only damaging themselves, they're damaging their children, the people that are around them. Women are really the backbone of a family. They really are. And it's important that we lead by example. And it's just very important. And I'm just going to kind of segue back to BT. That's why I don't like the videos that are being shown. I don't like the way women are being exploited. I don't like the way they're dancing around half-clothed. I mean, that's not appropriate. And these young women have got to understand they should have more respect for themselves, their bodies, and put their focus on trying to better themselves so that they can make a living and that they can have a good, strong family.
This medium of documentary storytelling also is really important to you. You've been a big supporter too, or promoter of the Middleburg Film Festival. Explain to us why documentary filmmaking and storytelling is so dear to you.
Well, I've besides doing A Powerful Noise, I've done Kicking It, which is about addiction and homelessness. I have done LSI Matador, about the only female matador in the world. My latest documentary is about 2 years old now. It's called The Other City, and it's about the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Washington, D.C. Through documentary film work, we are able to tell the story just like it really is. The documentary film work, to me, is like a piece of journalism on the screen. People love documentaries. They like seeing what's really happening out there. I mean, there was a documentary at Sundance called The Invisible War, and it's about the abuse of women in the military. That one film really opened the door in the minds of people on Capitol Hill to take a look at what was really happening. And I think it also empowered women to start speaking out, on the women in the military, to start speaking out on what was going on, even in their own private lives in the military. So I believe that documentary film work is that important. I really believe that through storytelling, we can create social change. I am bringing this film festival to Middleburg because this is an area where I think that we have so many wonderful young people and even older people where I can expose them to some of the best of independent filmmaking. And to be able to tell those stories and then also have panel discussions afterwards where we can have really good collaborative dialogue to talk about the issues that are going on in this world. Because I will tell you, this world is becoming more and more complicated. And until we open up the minds of people and until we're able to start communicating these issues, we are not going to go anywhere. And so this is a way of being able to bring issues to life and to be able to bring people from the area to really engage in dialogue about how these issues are affecting their lives personally, affecting our communities, and it's going to affect our children. That's why it's so important, and we're going to do 15 really special films. And then we've got 4 venues in which we're going to do it, and I just think it's going to be wonderful.
Entrepreneur Sheila Johnson. We'll be right back with more Virginia Conversations after this break. Thank you.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. We're back with entrepreneur Sheila Johnson. So we were talking about the Middleburg Film Festival. When is that coming up?
October 25th, 26th, and 27th.
That will be a really nice tie-in to the opening of Salamander Resort.
Yes, well, actually, the resort, it's going to be perfect that way. I have already had all the areas flushed out because the resort is actually going to ribbon cut on August 29th. So that gives us a good almost 2 months to really work the kinks out. It's going to be a lot of fun. We will have other events before the film festival, but the resort will be the focal point of, you know, housing our directors, some actors, some other celebrities, guests that are coming in for the film festival. We will have special parties, dinners, and we also want to use all of Middleburg for this. We're trying to do, you know, a breakfast with film directors. We can do that at the Red Fox Inn. We're going to be doing a special event at Boxwood Winery. We're going to try and use all our different areas within Middleburg, from the Sporting Library to the Middleburg Community Center, the Hill School, to really be able to not only showcase Middleburg, but also its retail, and to also just have fun, to look at movies, to be able to eat, to be able to walk around and shop. But it's a way of bringing people to this lovely little town.
I also want to talk about another business venture, your interest in sports franchises. You have ownership in three professional sports teams, the NBA's Washington Wizards, the Washington Mystics professional women's basketball team, and the NHL's Washington Capitals. Were those investment decisions, or because of the fact that you're a sports fan, or both?
It was definite decisions, and I am a sports fan. I have to say it was both. The thing about getting into sports franchises, that was a door that was shut to women forever. And this wonderful man, Abe Poland, who actually had a farm just behind me, and I had known Abe and Irene Poland for years and had gotten to know them socially. And one day, Abe Poland came to me and he said, I would like you to come meet me in my office next Tuesday at 2. And I'm like, okay, he wants me to do some sort of fundraising event for he and Irene and or be a part of it. So when I got in there, he offered me the Washington Mystics. And I just couldn't believe that this opportunity had come along. I started thinking about it, and I knew that Ted Leonsis had first right of refusal. He had already owned the Caps. He had first right of refusal on the Wizards. He was actually taking over the franchise. And so I went to my attorney, and I told him what was offered to me, and I said, this is a rare opportunity for a woman. And what we have to understand is when these doors open that are so unbelievably unusual, you may want to stop and think about this, not only how it's going to transform my life, but how it will transform other people's lives and what message is it sending. And I knew right away I wanted to do it, but I also knew that if I could propose to Ted Leonsis that I would like to buy into the Wizards and also into the hockey team, that I would like to be part of that ownership group. And Ted is gracious as he is, and he says, let me bring it to the other partners. And sure enough, they let me in. So I have to say, this has been, people call it a vanity buy. I will tell you, it's been one of the most wonderful experiences I ever had. And as David Stern said to me, I don't care how successful you've been in your life, you screw this up and you're a failure. I'm like, thank you, David. I really needed to hear that.
You became the first African-American woman to be an owner or partner in three sports franchises.
That's right.
Good move. So you knew you were being watched, so you couldn't drop the ball.
I really knew what I wanted to do with this. And hopefully they feel as though I've been a great partner. I'm a vice chairman of Monumental. I work very hard at it. My love is my women's team. I'm very excited about them. We got a new coach from Connecticut, Mike Tebow. I just think he's one of the finest coaches out there. We've already won our first game with Tulsa. I mean, every game is going to be tough. The WNBA gets stronger and stronger every year. They've got three marquee players that came out of the draft. They're going to be tough to beat, but we're going to do the best we can. And I think that the coach has put together a great rookie team for me. We've got four veterans that are still there, but our rookies, I think, have got a lot of upside and are working very hard.
It's great to see women's basketball getting some footing again, but what caused it to flag as it did? Why is it that women's basketball never got that momentum early on that it needed to get audiences out there?
Well, you have to understand it's a summer sport. People go away during the summer. The WNBA was birthed because the owners of the NBA teams and the ones that own the arenas, they needed to fill that space in the summertime. And so they came up with the idea of starting a WNBA franchise, which is great. It has really, you know, contrary to what people say, I think it's getting stronger and stronger. We just sealed an ESPN deal 2 months ago, which is giving every team another $1 million. We've had an ESPN deal before, but they've even doubled it. And that's sending a message out there that even ESPN believes in the sport. They're going to help us grow the sport. People need to come to a WNBA game. It is different from an NBA, only in the sense that there are women on the floor. But I will tell you something. These women play the purest form of the game. They are a force to be reckoned with. They are just absolutely terrific. And I have to say, in general, all women's sports, even in the LPGA, because I'm involved with the golf also, they all struggle for sponsorship dollars because the public, society, still, I do not believe, understands or respects women athletes. And I think they have to get over it and start supporting us.
It'd be nice if people could recognize what you just alluded to. You know, when I think of women's basketball and why I enjoy watching it, it's for the same reason I enjoy watching women's tennis. It is a very different game. There are longer rallies. It's a different approach altogether. And the same is true with women's basketball versus men's basketball. And I think all athletes, male or female, can appreciate those differences.
And with the NBA, you know, it's built around names. It's built around the celebrity basketball players. Yes, I can see the WNBA is starting to do that. You know, we got Brittany Griner, we got Deladon, we got Skylar Diggins, and the WNBA is doing the same thing that the NBA is doing. Their eyeballs are focused on those three women, those marquee players that came out of the draft, because it's being dictated by the networks. But what I'm trying to say to everyone, we got marquee players on every single team. I don't know how the men feel about it. I mean, I just know with the Wizards, I think we have great players too. But the people that get the attention, of course, are the Dwayne Wades, the LeBron James, the, you know, Chris Webbers, you know, it's those marquee players. And I can understand that because they got to do it for TV ratings. I really do understand that. But I think if there's a message that I can send to people out there, it is a wonderful sport that so many families should come out to watch. We are family-oriented. Even our dancers, I can't speak for the rest of the league, are children. So we really do focus on childhood obesity. We have a great sponsorship with Inova Hospital. We wear Inova's logo on our jersey. We go out into the community. We do a lot of work with young people and young families. And I think that is what makes the difference. We are about, and the NBA does give back, but we are really about giving back and really getting our hands dirty in the community and making things change, helping things change.
Do you think sports fans are slipping? You know, it seems we ask for much more than the athletics nowadays. We're interested in the drama, the stories of bad boys and bad behavior. And those are parts of our sports watching that seem almost de rigueur for professional athletics.
Yeah, I think it's not just in sports. I mean, we're seeing it across the board, even with TV stars, movie stars. We're seeing it across the board. I think there is behavior out there that is unacceptable. People love drama. They like things that happen like that. We do not even tolerate it with the WNBA. We will not. Yes, we have a couple of girls that have slipped and things have happened, but we take care of it right away. And I can only cite on one hand, you know, if we've had a couple of issues with a couple of our young women, they are not playing. We do not tolerate it, and we won't.
Moving on to another topic, back in 2011, your ex-husband and BET co-founder publicly disagreed with President Obama's stance toward big business and the rich. And by the way, he identifies, as you do, as a Democrat. He said, quote, "Attacking me is not going to convince me that I should take a bigger hit because I happen to be wealthy." And he also added, "I didn't go into business to create a public policy success for either party, Republican or Democrat. I went into business to create jobs, to create opportunity, to create value for myself and my investors." I'm interested to know where you stand with Obama.
I feel the same way. I mean, I have been a Democrat all my life. I literally crossed party lines, you know, and supported Bob McDonnell. And the reason why I did it, because he was about jobs and he was about the economy and he was about building businesses in Virginia. The Democratic candidate was not about any of that. And as much money as I have invested in the state of Virginia, I absolutely was not. I mean, I didn't even give it a second thought. Bob McDonnell was the right person to be elected governor. And yes, he's a Republican. I got attacked for it. I don't care. I really feel as though people have got to stop sitting in those political silos and understand there's a much bigger picture here. We should not let anybody feel entitled in checking the box for us. We have got to fight for what we believe in. And my job was, I'm creating jobs here in Virginia. I'm going to employ 300 people in this little town. That's more than I can say for a lot of people that I know out there who criticize me. I think it's important that if we step out of those silos and do the job that we feel as though is right, then it's going to solve a lot of problems out there.
As far as the Virginia gubernatorial race goes, who is your preferred candidate? And I'll give you a hint. You have to pick one of the actual candidates.
Oh, you know what? I'm going to watch both the candidates carefully, but I can tell you I'm leaning towards Terry McAuliffe.
Why?
I've known Terry for a long time. I feel unsettled with the other candidate. I just don't know what is happening there. I probably, in all honesty, I'm going to watch them both. Right now, I'm leaning towards Terry.
You just talked about the business angle. Is that the lens through which you're looking right now?
That's the lens in which I'm looking through, yeah.
Moving out of politics, who are your business idols? What entrepreneurs do you look up to?
Boy, I'm going to tell you something. I am getting ready to leave for Monte Carlo to be the U.S. judge for the Global Entrepreneurial Conference to choose the Global Entrepreneur of the Year. I have been going through about 47 proposals, resumes, and I have never seen smarter people on paper in my life. And just when I think I've seen it all, I see more. There are some unsung business heroes out there that I wish more people knew about. I can't divulge any of them right now. It's top secret. But I'm looking at about four or five of them that I'm looking up to. It's very hard to choose any one person. I watch a lot of people. I watch their successes. I watch things that didn't work out for them, and I'm taking stories and bits and pieces from each one of those portfolios and applying those lessons learned to mine.
Are there some who aren't on that list who you really look up to? Maybe who don't show up on that current list of entrepreneurs?
I'm just trying to think. I'll tell you one person I really admire is Michael Bloomberg. I just think that he's a genius. I like the way he thinks. I like the way he takes risk. I like the way he handles failure. And I like the way he has grown his business. I think Bloomberg is just an unbelievable media corporation that they started exactly when we did, and if you look at them now, they have stuck to their philosophy. He has really given that network a vision that is just spectacular. It's going to grow, it's continuing to grow, and it has the sustainability to be around forever, and people really respect the network. I have to say it's Michael Bloomberg. I mean, he could easily have been on this Ernst & Young list. He is so well-rounded in the sense that he has extraordinary business sense, but he also has a great heart. His philanthropic contributions, not only to the city of New York, but to the world in general, have just been extraordinary.
As we close out the program, I think listeners would love to hear, especially from your perspective, what your code of life is. Do you have a code that you live by?
Yeah, I think it's important that you really become, or you should be, an honest person. Integrity is everything in character. I think the two of them have to go together. They can't be separated out. They both define each other. But I think more importantly, I really believe that a person should have a very strong character, be true to themselves, and always live a life with high integrity.
Sheila Johnson, we are very much looking forward to the arrival of Salamander Resort and Spa in Middleburg, and that's coming up in August of this year.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Virginia Conversations. Well, that's all the time we have. I want to thank our guests, Rowena Fullenwider and Sheila Johnson. And thanks to you for tuning in this week. I'm Maylily Lee. We'll be back next week, same time, same place.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.